Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impacts these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Today, we have two gentlemen joining us from Rise ETF. The first runs the thematic research capability. Please welcome co-founder Rahul Bhushan. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. And the second is the product lead and also co-founder. Please welcome Stuart Forbes.
Hi there.
Hi. And our next guest is in charge of the extraordinary research team here at New Frontier Data. He is a regular here on Canna Week. Please welcome back our chief knowledge officer, Mr. John Kaguya.
It's great to be back, Heather. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, before we get started, guys, would one of you mind just giving our listeners who may not be familiar with Rise a quick rundown of who you are and what you do?
Sure. I can do that. So I suppose Rahul and I have worked together for a number of years now. We started out life at ETF Securities, which is a very known, well-known ETF provider here in Europe, but we also had a presence in the US. And in 2014, we started building thematic ETF funds, right? So funds that were focused on specific sectors or themes. And that was really an area that we were pioneers in Europe. So there was a lot of thematic investing going on in the US at the time, but not really in Europe. So we brought that over here, built the first robotics ETF in Europe. We built the first cybersecurity themed ETF in Europe. And then eventually the business was very successful. Legal in general, a very, very large asset manager, household name over here, came along and bought that business. And then we decided that we wanted to continue the thematic investing specialty that we had as a team. And so the four founders of Rise, so myself, Rahul, and a couple other guys, Anthony Martin, Jason Kennard, we all left Legal & General to go set up Rise. And this is where we're now focused very much on building thematic ETFs that provide exposure to particular emerging trends and themes that we see huge growth potential in the future, including, obviously, cannabis and medical cannabis specifically.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Well, we have a lot to discuss, so we're just going to dive right in. Today, SixGroup.com reported a new ETF issuer on the Swiss Stock Exchange, Six Welcomes Rise ETF. As of today, two more thematic ETFs with growth potential can be traded on the Swiss Stock Exchange, medical cannabis and cybersecurity. Congratulations. That's exciting news.
Yeah, it's great. Switzerland's a very important market for us, always has been. And it's a bit of a process to go through to get your funds registered in Switzerland and listed on the exchange, but hugely valuable once you're there. And really looking forward to getting cracking in that market.
Awesome. Well, if we can kind of pick your brain a little bit, we'd love to hear kind of your perspective on how, given the unique regulations governing cannabis in markets around the world, how is it different setting up a cannabis ETF relative to establishing an ETF in another sector?
Okay, so I guess the first thing to say is that, we're a little bit different to most other ETF providers out there in the way that we build our funds. So most other ETF providers out there who build thematic ETFs, things that provide exposure to particular themes, they normally license an index from an index provider, effectively. Whereas we actually build everything from scratch ourselves, and we go and we look for experts in each theme to partner with, right? So for example, New Frontier Data is our partner for the medical cannabis ETF. So that's the first thing. But in terms of the particular challenges that you have with a cannabis ETF compared to any other theme are the legal implications of investing in cannabis. So I think that the key thing that we sort of try to explain to investors here in Europe is that there are two different things. On the one hand, you've got can we be involved in cannabis related activities in our particular country in Europe, right? Can we grow cannabis? Can we sell it? Can we distribute it? Can we do that even for medical purposes? That's one thing. And the second thing is, can we invest in it, right? So if this part is illegal, is this part legal? And in many cases, that is the case, right? So even where the actual cannabis business itself would be illegal in the particular country in Europe, or even if it's medical, investing in companies overseas that are engaged legally in their activities overseas is okay. And that's governed by anti-money laundering regulation in Europe. And in Europe, you may be less familiar with this, but if you're a member of the European Union, there tends to be certain that there's a whole suite of regulations and directives that govern, on a pan-European basis. And countries have devolved a lot of that sort of regulatory control to the European Union as a whole. So, but then each country implements in slightly different ways. But what we find in Europe is that in most cases, they follow a very similar approach. And that basically says that, you know, each country has the ability to legalize cannabis or not, or legalize a medical cannabis program or not. And so you see some divergence there, and you see certainly some countries moving towards legalization, like Luxembourg. Germany's already got a very well established medical cannabis access program. It's legal in the UK more recently. From an investing point of view, what we've seen is a big divergence with respect to the UK. So if you're a UK investor, you cannot invest in a company that might be operating legally in Canada, even if it's in medical cannabis, if that activity would be illegal if carried out in the UK. So you have to look at the actual activities that are being carried out in the relevant country where it's legal and compare that to what's allowed in the UK. Now, it's not as simple as that. There's much more to it. But in essence, that's what it is. Whereas in Germany, in Switzerland, in Italy, and a lot of these other countries in Europe, they don't have that same those same sort of really stringent sort of restrictions. So as long as the activity is legal in, say, Canada, even if it's recreational cannabis that the company is involved with, then it would be a legal investment in Italy. Whereas in the UK, technically, you would be money laundering by investing in that activity and repatriating dividends or capital gains associated with that investment. So so for us, it was a real challenge to build this fund, because not only did we have to take into account the requirements around, you know, making sure that companies are operating legally in their respective countries, which is the criteria that applies to most countries here in Europe, i.e. if the country's operating in Canada, that's fine, as long as it's legal in Canada. If they're operating in the US, it's fine as long as they're operating legally at the federal level, right? So that means, you know, a lot of companies for us are out of bounds because they might be complying with Californian law, but they're not operating legally at the federal level, which means they typically don't have a listing on a major exchange, and they would be an illegal investment for us here in Europe. That applies across all countries. In the UK, we've got to go a step further, and we have to make sure that we're only investing in companies that are sort of involved in the medical cannabis sector and the hemp sector. So nothing that's sort of straying into the recreational cannabis space.
Got it. Okay, so this seems very, very complicated. How do you help curb an investor's fears or kind of dumb it down for them so they're comfortable making these investments?
So the whole idea of the fund that we built is we solve all of that for investors, because you've got to remember, you try and explain this to an investor and their compliance team, they're just like, I'm lost. I don't know where to start. It's going to take me a year to get my head around this if I spend all my time looking at it. Probably going to have to get external legal advice. It's complicated. So yeah. So that is, I mean, it took us a year to build that fund, right? So we have a 50-page compliance memo, the structuring memo, which basically goes through all the regulations and all the different requirements. And what we end up with is a very rigorous multi-tiered due diligence process that we go through with respect to the companies that ultimately feed into the index that our fund replicates, right? So what happens is, from a very high level, we obviously exclude any company that is identified as a cultivation retail company by New Frontier Data. That's a very easy exclusion that we can do. It's pre-classified. But then what we have to do with all the remaining companies is look at each one, carry out due diligence on it, look through its public statements, and assess whether it's involved in the recreational adult use space. If it is, we exclude it. The other thing we have to do is we have to make sure that company is operating legally in its relevant country. Now, you might think, ooh, this company's got a big listing on a major exchange and therefore it's fine. It's not necessarily. So just because a company has a big listing doesn't necessarily mean it's fully compliant. And we've seen that with one or two companies, and we have to exclude them on that basis. So we actually have a public exclusion methodology that we publish on our website. And at the back of that is an actual exclusion list. And the methodology is objective. Is the company operating legally in the relevant country? You know, is it involved in recreational cannabis, yes or no? And then if it ticks either one of those boxes, we then list it at the back of that document, and that's public on our website so people can see why we've excluded a particular company. So the idea of this is to provide confidence and reassurance to investors when investing in this sector. And this is something that, you know, we had to agree with all kinds of different parties who are involved in the asset management ecosystem with us, right? So our independent depository, they have to be happy and comfortable because they're holding these stocks in custody for the fund. Right. So they're the primary, party that we have to satisfy. Auditors, stock exchanges, also the regulator that regulates the fund. So very important that everybody is happy with your arrangements. And then you go and get your fund authorized, and then there's a lot more confidence in that whole structure. So we're basically solving this complicated legal problem for investors.
Amazing. John, how does New Frontier play into all of this? How has your team been involved with Rise?
So we've had the pleasure of collaborating with the Rise team and actually providing them the lists of the leading publicly traded cannabis companies that then Rise uses to define who the companies which will be included in the ETF are going to be. And given some of the dynamism that the cannabis industry has faced over the past 18 to 24 months, obviously that list has evolved in the time that we've been working with Rise. But, you know, the onus is on us to make sure that, you know, the data we're providing Rise is timely, accurate, and robustly curated to ensure that the inputs that they're curating to feed into the ETF are reflective of, you know, the most up-to-date status of these companies, particularly given, you know, the regulatory requirements that Stuart has just articulated. You know, this is a high stakes game for the stakeholders, and given the regulatory scrutiny that this industry currently is under, really important that the inputs that feed into the ETF are right. So that's where the burden of New Frontier comes in.
Yeah, and it seems like this is something that the regulations are changing regularly for all these different places. So it's hard to keep up and make sure that everyone's in compliance.
You can explain it really simply in about 30 seconds. But you either have that version or you have a half an hour, 1 hour version, which most people just at the end of it don't remember.
Well, you just went through a lot of the different things that, you know, standards for international investors and stuff. What are some of the areas where cannabis companies are falling short as far as leading investor expectations?
So I guess the short answer is promises. I think what you've seen in the public markets is a lot of promises to deliver certain levels of revenues, certain levels of earnings, certain sales growth. And I think there's been a sort of retail excitement around the industry as well in 2016, 2017 in particular, where these stock valuations have just exploded to the point, or ballooned rather, to the point where, you know, the expectations on the management teams have just become so high. And then that's resulted in obviously them not being able to deliver against those expectations. And so 2018 and 2019 as well have really been a period of adjustment for the industry. I think there's been an adjustment. The investors have had to adjust to the reality. And I think the management teams have had to basically roll back some of their plans because they've realized that these ambitious growth targets, you know, perhaps expanding into Europe or Latin America or Asia or Africa, you know, perhaps their growth targets were a bit too ambitious. And so they've rolled back some of those plans. The other thing with the cannabis industry, I think at the moment, and I'm speaking generally about the whole of the market, which includes the cultivation and retail companies, which Stu mentioned, you know, come out of our ETF. The other thing here is that the market has really experienced this explosive growth, But what hasn't happened yet is banking reform. And so these companies, when they need capital, they only really have one source to go to, and that is the equity capital market. And so investors, if you're an investor in a cannabis company, you know, if they're coming to the equity market every single time for capital, your shares are being diluted. So your investment is essentially deflationary for as long as these guys can't access debt. And so there is a little bit of a realization, I think, that's happened, perhaps first on the retail side, and for the, let's say, more adventurous institutional investors that are participating in this market, to think, okay, well, perhaps it's a good time to start cherry picking companies, number one, so that better capitalized companies that don't need to go back to the equity market as often. But I think the other thing that's happened is some people are just waiting on the sidelines and waiting for that banking reform to happen, where these companies can use leverage to grow. And of course, there's been, you know, more and more companies like Innovative Industrial Properties that have, you know, performed these sort of shadow banking operations where, you know, they do this sort of buy and then lease back, much in the same way as you would do with aircraft. They're buying these warehouses and essentially, you know, putting cash on the balance sheet of some of these cultivation companies. Now, of course, where we focus, it's a slightly different area, of course, because it's the healthcare side of cannabis. It's the medicinal side. If you really start unpacking our product, you very quickly realize that it's almost 70% pharmaceutical cannabis companies, if you include some of the big pharma names like Novartis, Teva, AbbVie, and Perrigo, which are the four big pharma names that come into our fund for a fixed allocation of 10% at every index rebalance. But really 70% being pharmaceutical cannabis. And of course here, the demand is much more inelastic because, you know, people that need this, you know, medicinal cannabis for health reasons, whether we're in a good economy or in a bad economy, you know, if you have chronic pain or if you have anxiety or if you have arthritis perhaps, and you're using, whether it's the pharmaceutical option or the natural, you know, hemp derived organic option, which you're buying in Whole Foods or shops similar to that, you know, you need this stuff because it's helping you. And you know, the demand, you know, certainly is more inelastic. And as a result, I think that industry has been a slightly more resilient. You know, a big affirmation for the industry has also this year been that cannabis has been deemed an essential business in the US. So if you think about that, you know, it's really a sort of an affirmation by the state and the lawmakers that, you know, this is an important industry and, you know, these patients really need this medicine. And so that's been exciting to see. And it's certainly provided some impetus, I think, to the, especially the medical side of the industry. Now, what's really interesting is that the medical side itself is quite a small subsector within the larger cannabis ecosystem. And to use some numbers here, you know, the data that we license from New Frontier Data is a list of 303 companies, but our ETF only holds 27 of those. So you can see, you know, Stu talked in detail about that regulatory legal process through which the companies need to filter through to make their way into our fund. You know, 303 is the global cannabis ecosystem, 27 companies. So there really is a lot of filtration, and there really is a process of trying to identify these companies that really are exposed to that healthcare tailwind in the cannabis space.
John, do you have anything to add to that as far as areas where cannabis companies may be falling short?
Well, you know, I think Rahul is dead on. And maybe just to expand a bit on this point about this transition that we've seen between 2018 and 2019 coming into the 2020 through 21 cycle, which is, you know, there was a lot of irrational exuberance in the period in the industry between, say, 2016 through 2018. And part of the reason for that is because of how much retail investors were driving the market, and, you know, people really excited about the prospect of cannabis. I think there were unrealistic expectations around how quickly states were going to legalize cannabis, particularly major markets like the New Yorks and New Jerseys, Floridas of the world. I think there was really unrealistic expectations at how national governments were going to perform in terms of adopting new legalization measures, both in the US and in Europe. And then third, I think there were very unrealistic expectations about how quickly these markets were actually going to materialize post-legalization. And Canada, I think, has been a great example of that, where the first 18 months of that market post-legalization, its growth was much slower than the most kind of Pollyannish or rose-colored glass-wearing investors had anticipated. But below that, I think there were some really serious investors, serious operators who were understanding that this was going to be a long-term play. And while this initial kind of explosion that people expected didn't really materialize in many ways, it didn't actually neutralize any of the strong underlying fundamentals. And I think Rahul has spoken really eloquently to those, which are that the science is strongly affirming the opportunity that medical cannabis represents. The governments are realizing that not only from a public health standpoint, but from a kind of public return standpoint in terms of tax revenues, in terms of job creation, cannabis is actually a positive, is a net positive for local and state governments. And that with this very dramatic shift we're seeing in public opinion, that there's been this very strong public embrace of the idea of the role that medical cannabis in particular can play as a supplement or as a complement to the pharmacopoeia that patients already have access to, and particularly as a displacement for some of the pharmaceuticals that we may be having issues with, for example, opioids. So the opportunity, I think, remains really, really strong. And the mistake that some of the companies made early on about just being hyper-aggressive in their expansion plans. I mean, the fact that so many companies are now having to sell excess capacity, pull out of markets that they got into too early, is a reflection of this recalibration that's happening. But when you look at the long-term opportunity that we see in cannabis, both on the medical side and then more broadly in the recreational side, New Frontiers modeling estimates that global total demand for cannabis today is at about $350 billion annually. That's largely recreational demand, admittedly. And so it doesn't include the opportunity that medical cannabis will represent, doesn't include the opportunity that industrial hemp and its activation will represent and all of those downstream applications. So you can very quickly see how this starts getting toward a $1 trillion opportunity when you start integrating all of these applications. And while we fully acknowledge that it will take a little time to fully capitalize on all of these applications, for the companies that focus on the fundamentals, that are realistic in their planning, that are bringing strong teams that understand navigating emerging markets and understand navigating through resilience challenging times, I think the long-term opportunities that we're going to see here are going to be very, very substantial. And the companies that get it right now, that figure out how to build for the market as it currently is, but understands the agility and responsiveness required for the market that is coming, will be very, very well positioned to be the leaders and the vanguard in this long-term growth opportunity.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, I couldn't possibly have an episode where I didn't talk about something COVID-related right now. So to the Rise guys, as we begin to see the COVID-related economic contraction, what are your short to midterm outlook for cannabis public markets?
So yeah, I'll take that. We've obviously seen the bottom of the I can speak specifically about the medical market perhaps to begin with, and then we can kind of broaden from there with John's input as well. But I think on the medical side, it's been exciting to see since 2018 what's been happening on that side. Of course, in 2018, we saw Epidiolex approved by the FDA, and that drug or medicine, as some people prefer to call these things medicine, got approved and is now being distributed and marketed in the US. Recently was approved in 28 countries by the European Medicines Agency. So it's going to be rolled out in Europe as well. So the sort of medicinal story, I think, is live and well. In Germany, for example, if you are prescribed medical cannabis, it's now covered under an insurance program. So that's obviously helped demand, and Germany is one of the biggest European markets. But I think we're really at the tip of the iceberg here. And you know, COVID or no COVID, I think, you know, we're still at the tip of the iceberg. You know, we've got this one medication from one company, GW Pharma, that's approved in two continents. And I think, you know, as our understanding of other cannabinoids increases, you know, at the moment, I think we understand, you know, at best five or six different cannabinoids, and not particularly well either. I mean, we understand them, I think, even, you know, at very sort of surface level, but we've seen, you know, some of these applications, and we've seen certain cannabinoids work for certain conditions. But I think, you know, that's five. If we understand five, and if with the understanding that there's over 100 different cannabinoids in the plant, plus the flavonoids, plus the terpenes, and then, you know, whatever else you people might discover, combinations of these things, I think that, you know, we are probably in over the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see a lot more medicines come to the market. I mean, a lot of medicines are currently being trialed or in that sort of clinical process, going through the FDA life cycle. And I think as some of those medicines come to market, you know, you'll see this, the sort of pent up demand that's waiting for alternatives to what's currently available is going to sort of immediately jump at these new solutions. And that's what we saw with Epidiolex. You know, I think there wasn't really any viable, scalable medicine prior to that to really address these seizures that were being experienced by patients. And you know, the uptake has been incredible. Even if you look at GW Pharma's revenues, I think they've gone from, you know, 15 million just 2 years ago to over 300 million today. And that's happened, you know, in 18 months. So, and on the back of one drug, right? So I think we're really at the tip of the iceberg. And I don't think, you know, I think the pandemic is, you know, may put some impetus behind, you know, how lawmakers and regulators think about the importance of the cannabis sector within their states. I think increasingly there's going to be an interest in increasing tax revenues using whatever way possible and spurring economic growth. But I think that's a story that's happening at the macro, let's say. But on the micro, you know, there's still research and development happening around the medical use cases for various cannabinoids, and that's certainly not slowed down. And I think that's going to continue. And I think John, I mentioned some. I did read something from John actually a couple of weeks ago, where he even mentioned that there were some universities in the U.S. who have established academic cannabis programs that are now allocating certain amount of budgets to basically research and development of cannabinoids for medicinal use. So I do think that, you know, while the macro may sort of give a natural tailwind, you know, we talked about tax revenues, we've talked about the opioids and how cannabis presents a viable, scalable, low cost, less addictive, plant derived alternative for these patients. You know, I think at the same time, you kind of have to think about, I suppose, the micro, where the research and development hasn't stopped. And I think as time goes on, we'll unearth more use cases for various cannabinoids. And that's going to result in more medicines, and those medicines will target more conditions.
Amazing. John, anything to add from you?
Yeah, I think I would actually echo everything Rahul said, and maybe just a couple of points that I think are also worth considering in this context of the immediate applicability of cannabis as a wellness enhancement. So if you think about the one of the major consequences of the COVID pandemic has been to dramatically elevate the levels of stress and anxiety in our society. And critically, we're actually seeing globally reports of some of the most acute sleep disruption that doctors who focus on sleep have seen in their lifetime. So people are deeply kind of in a deep state of disquiet because of the pandemic and its associated economic effects. And there's, you know, there's, as one of the outcomes of that is people having a lot of trouble sleeping. Now, in the context of that, given that the three of the primary reasons why people use cannabis or cannabinoids are to help with stress, to reduce anxiety, and to improve their sleep outcomes, we think this is a really kind of singular opportunity right now to elevate the recognition that you know, cannabis provides a really kind of effective alternative to some of the pharmaceuticals in alleviating some of the disquiet being caused by the pandemic. And I think that's going to spur greater use. We're already seeing it in our data that demand over the past 2 months has gone through the roof in the markets that we're tracking. And we think that's part of the reason is people integrating it to just alleviate some of the stress and anxiety. And then second, you know, to this point of tax revenues, the economic stimulus of activating legal cannabis. While we already think that that is underway in North America, we'll be following really closely what happens in some of the global markets, which are being really, really battered by the pandemic and its shutdown. I think we're going to start seeing, as a result of this, a much more concerted and robust discussion around legalization in markets globally. And while that may not necessarily lead to immediate activation of more publicly traded cannabis companies, it catalyzes a more robust global conversation about an emerging global cannabinoid economy. And, you know, as we see that play out over the next 18 to 24 months, you know, the fact that just in the past 6 to 8 weeks, we've seen countries as far as Lebanon and Ghana legalize cannabis, specifically for the economic benefit and for some of the medical applications for their local markets. We think that brings a lot more seriousness to stakeholders who might be on the sidelines, who recognize that even if there may only be a handful of real robust players in the legal markets today, as you start seeing more companies activate these markets, the opportunity to build a robust global ecosystem grows. And with that, so does the market opportunity that this industry will represent.
Awesome. Stuart, anything to add?
We're excited to see what's going to come in the future. You know, I think one of the areas that we're keeping a close eye on as well, in conjunction with you guys, is obviously what, you know, specifically in the medical sector, is what Big Pharma is doing. So, you know, I think, you know, there's obviously every pharmaceutical under the sun has filed a whole lot of patents and everything else. But what we're interested in, and where companies are making a bit more of a, I guess, taking a bit more of a serious step into that. So we've seen one of Novartis's subsidiaries enter into a distribution agreement with Tilray. You know, this is the kind of thing that isn't going to happen lightly, right? So Novartis isn't going to allow, you know, one of its subsidiaries just to lightly enter into a global distribution agreement with a cannabis company. That absolutely would have been signed off at the top levels, risk committees, global risk committees, steering committees, whatever you want to call them, at Novartis, right? So we've seen the same thing, I believe it's with Teva. I think we'll see more of these as these companies sort of slowly dip their toes in and you know, before diving in entirely, they'll dip the toes in slowly. But these companies we're keeping an eye on, and we expect to see more of that as we continue.
And maybe just a quick kind of dovetail off of that, which is that as you know, we've talked a bit about the implications of the 2020 election. Obviously, there's quite a number of states that are looking at both medical and adult use initiatives in the US. But I'd actually be watching very closely the congressional makeup of the incoming cohort in the 2021 congressional cycle, because I think that's going to be critical in determining whether in 2021 we will see federal relaxation of banking rules for cannabis businesses. I think it is becoming increasingly untenable to say that this is, you know, a nearly $20 billion industry in the US and it still is unbanked. And if we do see reform at the national level, regardless of what happens at the presidential level, this is going to be a congressionally driven initiative. And if we see a relaxation of banking rules, the ability for cannabis businesses to now have full faith and credit, full participation in the global banking ecosystem, then I think that becomes another major catalytic event to both the ability for companies to be publicly traded, but also the seriousness with which institutional investors can start to look at this industry.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Well, this is a good place. We'll leave it here today. Thank you all for joining us today at Canna Week. Please be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast. You can find these news stories and more on New Frontier Data's Cannabis Insights Daily. Thank you again to our guests and listeners. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. We'll see you next time.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.